Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Back to the Women's Podcast. If you are listening for the first time, it's great to have you. Thank you. Come on in. The water's lovely. If you're a regular listener, thank you again for joining us. And you will, of course, notice that I am not Roisin Ingle. I'm Aideen Finnegan, Irish Times audio producer, and I'm just keeping Roisin's seat warm for a week. Today, we are discussing the much misunderstood, poorly researched, extremely common condition that is endometriosis. It's a chronic disease that affects at least 1 in 10 people, mostly women, but it can affect anyone, you know, any age, any race, any gender, cis, trans, doesn't matter. It can take an average of 9 years to get a diagnosis, but I can tell you it took me 18 years and it took my guests today a similar length of time and involved a very difficult journey to get to that point.
That was really the start of the 18-year investigation to a diagnosis finally, and kind of seeing all sorts of doctors, you know, rheumatologists, immunologists, gastroenterologists, you name it, to be misdiagnosed many times along the way.
That was Dervil Orman there, and we will hear a little bit more from Dervil later. But in some other news that caught my eye this week, well, first of all, there was Olivia Colman on the gender pay gap. Now, Olivia is an exceptionally accomplished actor, as you will be familiar with her, I'm sure. She has starred in roles as diverse as Queen Elizabeth in The Crown to Sophie in Peep Show. You know, she's done the whole gamut. She's an extremely versatile actress, can do pure comedy and really serious roles. Turn her hand to anything. And yet she will not get paid as much as her male co-star. Have a listen to her speaking on CNN this week while publicising her new movie, Wicked Little Letters.
Don't get me started on the pay disparity, but male actors get paid more because they used to say they draw in the audiences, and actually that hasn't been true for decades. But they still like to use that as a reason to not pay women as much as their male counterparts.
I actually started my career in radio in 2004. Now, thankfully, I worked in a station that had many women on air, but I can vouch for the fact that in the industry at that time, there was this sort of received wisdom that you couldn't put a female DJ on air because nobody wants to listen to women's voices, which just felt like such a fallacy at the time. And there is Olivia saying they still trot out that excuse that, you know, you have to pay the man more money because people need to see him to come to the movie. Yes, we call BS on that. Brianna Parkins has written about her comments in the Irish Times this week. You can read that article on irishtimes.com. It's titled Olivia Colman Used the F Word Over Gender Pay Gap. We all should. And while you're there, I'm going to tell you, you should subscribe to read all of Brianna and Roisin's brilliant words on this and many other female related topics. irishtimes.com/subscribe. Elsewhere, Cameron Diaz has given birth to a baby boy at the age of 51. So earlier this week, the actor announced that she and her husband, Benji Madden, who's 45, had a baby boy that they called Cardinal. They already have a 4-year-old daughter called Radix. Now, I can't lie. I will keep my judgy qualms to myself. I think those names are mad. What the hell? But on the issue of her becoming a mom again at 51, as you can imagine, she has drawn the ire of people on the internet who think she has no business getting pregnant as a quinquagenarian. I think more power to her. We at the Women's Podcast are delighted for her. Other famous women who have had babies in their 50s include Janet Jackson, Naomi Campbell and Hilary Swank. And if Al Pacino and Mick Jagger and Robert De Niro can father children in their 70s and 80s without being vilified, then there's no reason women should be subjected to that double standard. Now, on the subject of having babies, our topic today is endometriosis, and it's a condition that for half of those diagnosed with it, they'll find it difficult to get pregnant. Why? we don't know. There's a long list of don't knows when it comes to endo. As with many diseases that predominantly affect women, surprise, surprise, there's not enough research into it to find out things like, you know, what causes infertility. We don't know if it causes it. There's just a correlation between the number of people diagnosed with it and those who find it difficult to get pregnant. There's no cure. If there is a cure, we don't have it yet. So you can only manage the symptoms. Now, there is a growing awareness amongst the medical community in Ireland, but unfortunately, there is still a big information gap there. So it means people can wait years and years and see many doctors before they get diagnosed. And I can say my own personal experience when I went to a doctor about it, it was just a case of, yeah, some women do have very painful periods. You can only be diagnosed by having a laparoscopy, and that is keyhole surgery, where the surgeon goes in with a camera to examine the pelvic cavity for lesions. And in some cases, they may take them off at that point. But as you can imagine, there's quite a few steps before you end up at the point where you can have that, you know, on the surgeon's table and get a treatment plan put in place after that. So that's why if you feel this could be something you suffer from, or you suspect you could suffer from, or someone you know may have it, there is a community out there who can help you navigate the different patient pathways, but it is a bit of a muddle. And so my guests today are Dervil Ormond and Johanna Huber. And Dervil is an entrepreneur whose experience with endo led her to create the Frendo app and Frendo at Work. They are tools that are designed to help women struggling with endo or suspected endo. And she herself has been through the mill with the condition. Happily and against all odds, she gave birth to her miracle baby 2 years ago. She has since had a hysterectomy as a treatment for adenomyosis, and she'll explain a little bit more about that. Johanna Huber is a German woman living in Cork. She is a physiotherapist and a yoga teacher, and more about how both of those things can help ameliorate symptoms in a little bit. But I started off by asking, because Johanna is an advocate for better healthcare in this area, I started off by asking her to explain a bit more about what exactly endo is.
So it's a chronic inflammatory condition that impacts the whole body and that can cause infertility, debilitating pain. And it can have very different symptoms. So it was quite long believed to only be menstrual pain, period pain. But we know now that this is not the case. And funny enough, like the uterus and the fallopian tubes aren't actually the first place where endometriosis can be found. So it's endometrial-like tissue that behaves similar to the lining of the womb that you can find in literally any place in the body. On the bladder, the bowel, on the kidneys, the urethras, on the diaphragm, the lungs, the heart, the brain. And there it can cause inflammation. That inflammation can cause blood vessels to rupture, to bleed, and that bleeding can cause scarring, adhesions between organs that can tie the organs together, that can make those organs dysfunctional, create organ dysfunction and pain, that can cause pain itself because the organs aren't moving properly anymore. And the most common symptoms would be menstrual pain, pain with intercourse, but also pain with filling or emptying your bladder, pain with filling or emptying your bowel. And at some stage, that might not just be when filling and emptying, that could be constant. And it has a huge impact on women's life. It can have way more symptoms depending on which organs are being impacted. But those would be the major symptoms, which unfortunately over 60% of the GPs still don't recognize, which is a huge issue.
And when you say pain, Johanna, I know that that's very individual to the person. But if somebody's listening and going, I don't know if the pain I have is the pain you're talking about, is there a way you'd be able to describe it?
So if you have period pain, and it's so strong, or the cramps are so strong, that you need to take painkillers, and you need to take painkillers regularly, that is not normal. Period pain should not be so painful that you have to take painkillers regularly, or that you have to cancel plans, that you have to rock your life around it. And especially when it comes to bladder and bowel, like endometriosis itself is not a sexy disease. So it's bowel, bladder, sexual, menstrual issues. So it's not something people are very comfortable talking about, which means a lot of people would never mention it to the GP or talk to other people. So it's really hard to know then what's normal. But you should not have pain when you're emptying your bladder. You should not have to constantly go to the toilet because there's this urgency. You should not have cramps and be in tears and be gasping for air and feel like you're passing out when there's a bowel movement or even just passing gas. So if that pain is more than something you can sort with one or two painkillers, and you have to change your life and you have to cancel things, that is not normal and that should be investigated.
Mm. I think we'll talk a bit more about how normalized that has become a little bit later. But Derval, can I ask you, your symptoms started when you were 16, am I right?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. So I suppose that's the first memory I have of them really interfering significantly with my life. We were away as a family on a family trip for a weekend for my brother's birthday, and I spent the majority of it in a hotel room. And it was, I suppose, how I describe it is, you know, erratically unwell, where the problem with this disease, as Johanna has quite rightly pointed out, is it's an invisible disease, you know, but also it's erratic in its nature. So the symptoms can really come on really quite severely in a very short period of time. And that's what happened when I was 16 on that trip. I felt like a rope was wrapping itself tightly around my lower abdomen and pelvis. And I, you know, was extremely sick. And that was really the start of the 18-year investigation to a diagnosis, finally, and kind of seeing all sorts of doctors, you know, rheumatologists, immunologists, gastroenterologists, you name it, and to be misdiagnosed many times along the way. And I think, you know, that the thing with that is, if we look at the young age that this kind of creeps in, that really kind of played havoc with me, you know, in my mental health as well as my physical health. As Johanna said, they're not the most glamorous of symptoms. So I found myself isolating myself away because of kind of being embarrassed or feeling really uncomfortable in my body and in a body that I was supposed to be kind of protecting and loving and growing. And that, you know, I would say that really, really affected me in my early adulthood.
And did you know to go to the doctor straight away that, you know, this pain isn't normal? Or was there an element of, oh, I've heard some people get worse period pains than others? Were you conscious that what you were feeling was different?
Well, there was absolutely no mention of endometriosis then. I'm, you know, old. I'm 42, so that's quite a while ago. So there was no mention of that. But I wouldn't say I knew to go to the doctor. Look, I was very lucky in that I'm the daughter of a GP. So, you know, I had that, I suppose, step forward. But still, it took 18 years because they're, and he'd be the first to admit, they're not historically educated in this at all. And so I knew something was wrong. I knew something was wrong throughout all those misdiagnoses, throughout all the things. But you kind of, you're at the mercy of these doctors. You go in, sadly, almost expecting to come out and be told your test results were all fine, you know, and they would never have said this, but you absolutely feel like it's all in your head. You feel like a burden to those around you because, you know, you're going to doctor after doctor. And then I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and there was kind of a, well, there you go now, isn't that it? And I knew, absolutely knew there was more to it. So, you know, I'm a huge believer in be the CEO of your own health. Like this, you know it best. You know if there is something wrong. And if there is something wrong, you have to keep pushing to find answers.
I know that many people with endometriosis have one particular flare-up or one particular episode in their memory that was really, really difficult. Do you have one of those?
Yeah, I do. I'd say I have two significant ones, but one is most recent. One was when I was in Australia as well, and I collapsed and cracked my chin open and broke my sternum.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
That was as a result of, again, I didn't know what it was at the time, but it was as a result of pain after sex. And, you know, I have found that quite difficult to talk about up until recently, because I think maybe it's just an Irish thing, but we don't generally talk about those things. And I didn't know it was because of that. But most recently, I had a daughter, you know, against all the odds, but I did have a daughter 3 years ago. And when she was 6 weeks old, I was at home on my own with her, holding her, and I had excruciating pain on kind of a scale of 1 to 10. It was up there around 9, and causing me to collapse. And I had to call some family members over to come and look after my daughter. I ended up in A&E. And yeah, that is, I think, the scariest, because it involved someone else. And I think this is what we really have to understand, is others are also affected, whether it be your partner, your parents, your child. This is a disease that can literally come on whenever, and it can take over your whole body. And that meant me just lying down for kind of 45 to 50 minutes until I was able to move again.
And how did you come out of it? Did you just have to wait until the pain subsided, or did you have to work through it? Because, you know, when you have a child, yeah, you don't have that luxury anymore of just going to bed and closing the curtains and forgetting the world is outside.
Yeah, well, I my aunt lived close by, so I had to call her to come over and look after my daughter. And I had to just go to bed, wait for medication, the strong medication, to kick in. And then I made my way to the hospital. And I'll be honest with you, I remember thinking and saying to my partner then, there's no point in me going to hospital, but, you know, and I'd say all of us would agree with that, because I know I'll walk out of there being told the same thing I've always been told. But I did it, you know. And 6 weeks after I'd had a baby, the endometriosis had grown back, and I was also diagnosed with adenomyosis. So I had been hemorrhaging quite a bit as well at the time.
Oh my God. And for people who may not be familiar, adenomyosis is a relative of endo.
It is, yeah. It's when the disease is actually in the uterus. So I recently had a hysterectomy to actually try to mitigate and manage the symptoms of that.
Which is the most nuclear option, isn't it? I mean,
I mean, you kind of, you know, it was a huge, huge decision that took, you know, immense consideration. But I suppose I was in a position where, even if I was able to have another child, would I actually have been able to manage another child? You know, not being able to make my way up the stairs quite often during the month. And, you know, the positive is that I definitely think my symptoms have reduced in the last 4 months. The recovery was extremely difficult. And again, when you have a child, when you have a job, when you have all of these things, you know, also I had excision surgery at the same time to remove the disease, which is the gold standard in treatment for this disease. And, you know, that's time off work for people without even a hysterectomy that they have to take. So, yeah, I had tried everything else, and that was kind of the last straw, unfortunately. But I am really hopeful.
Johanna, you've had a number of surgeries as well in the last 2 years. Can you tell us about that?
So, like Daryl already said, excision from all places and fully is the gold standard of treatment for endometriosis. And unfortunately for adenomyosis, there is a cure, which is hysterectomy. But a hysterectomy does not treat endometriosis. So hysterectomy is really just to treat adenomyosis, and it's a very severe decision to make. So the problem with excision surgery is that it's not readily available in Ireland. And we don't have the multidisciplinary team that we should have to treat it to the standard of care.
And would you explain what that is, Johanna? What is excision?
So there is at the moment two procedures that are available for endometriosis, for surgically treating endometriosis. And one is way more readily available, and that's ablation, that's burning the surface of the disease. And that can leave a lot of disease behind. There is no way of sending anything to the laboratory to test, was it actually endometriosis or not. But it also has a very high recurrence rate, between 70 and 100%. It causes a lot of inflammation, a lot of scarring, and can subsequently cause more symptoms. And it doesn't take the disease actually out of the body. And this is where excision surgery, where you cut the full disease out from every organ, really gives you a way better recurrence rate. So the recurrence rate being done by actual experts is below 12%. So there's a huge difference between a recurrence rate of below 12% and 80 to 100% recurrence rate. But you need way more training to be able to offer that. And at the moment, we don't have a surgeon in Ireland being able to offer that sort of treatment. So when I had my very first surgery, which was done under one of the top 5 endometriosis surgeons in Ireland, that was a very unsuccessful surgery, and that left me in way more pain, although they were suggesting that surgery was really needed in order to take my pain away, which at that stage was so debilitating that I couldn't even work anymore. And like Derval already said earlier, it's not just cyclical, that pain. That pain can be constant and that pain can be very erratic. And for a reason, endometriosis is classified as one of the top 20 most painful conditions one can suffer. It's being rated higher than unmedicated labor, childbirth. Mix in heart attack symptoms, and that's not like you have this once a month or every couple of months. You could have this for 2-3 hours, and heart attack pain and unmedicated labor pain together. And this could happen for hours on end, and this could repeat itself within 24 hours a couple of times. So because that failed first surgery in Ireland left me way more pain, I then learned enough to know that the Irish standard of care is rather substandard, and that my only chance of getting some sort of life quality back is finding an actual excision expert. And there's not many available, considering there's around 200 million people in the world suffering from the disease, and around 150,000 alone in Ireland. There's very few surgeons who can actually offer expert excision, and you unfortunately have to travel to where the surgeons are. So I had 2 follow-up surgeries to fix the first surgery in Ireland, and I went abroad to the Bucharest Endometriosis Centre. And considering I had 0 life quality before, and my first surgery in Ireland just gave me so much more pain you can't even imagine. Ever since those 2 surgeries, I have 0 pain left. And that is just quite huge, and I'm not an exception. So everyone is obviously quite different. But that center I went to, they do around 400 endometriosis surgeries a year, whereas the center I went to in Ireland does only around 40 a year. And you can't just compare that. And the center, the Bucharest Endometriosis Center, 1/3 of their clients are Irish. So you can do the maths. There is, and I don't know the current numbers because the stats for this year haven't come out yet, but there's at least 100 plus Irish women every year just traveling to this one specific surgeon to get the standard care of endometriosis that's not available in Ireland at the moment. And that's not the only surgeon Irish patients travel to. So we estimate it's not just 100 plus, it's way more, who are forced to leave the country every year.
I'd like to come back to that, because we did have somebody on the podcast before, Amy Brown, who had travelled to Romania under the cross-border directive. And we'll come back to that. But you mentioned, Johanna, your quality of life. You had 0 quality of life. How was it manifesting for you? Were you in Ireland when you developed it, or did you have this when you were in Germany? Because I should mention you are, in fact, German. Yeah. I haven't mentioned that yet. For listeners, will have heard your accent. So is this something that you had in Germany that you were getting good treatment for? For managing the pain, and you didn't get it in Ireland?
So you would think, because I'm living in Ireland 10 years now, that Germany is very different, because Germany has a way better healthcare system. But unfortunately, even Germany doesn't have the standard of care and doesn't have enough surgeons to actually be able to deal with the disease properly. So my first symptoms started when I was 12. I was officially diagnosed 22 years later. My symptoms were ignored and dismissed, probably because my period pain was severe and my bleeding was severe, but I never knew it any different, so I didn't think it was abnormal. I just lived with it. So my symptoms then really got bad in my early 20s, where I was just struggling to breathe, and I was really active in physio school. I was exercising multiple times a week, but I simply couldn't get up the stairs without having to stop halfway in between and catch my breath. And that's just not normal in your early 20s. And I had severe stomach pains at that stage. And I was obviously misdiagnosed, how a lot of endo patients were misdiagnosed with IBS. And for my breathing struggles, I just couldn't find anything. So they told me to start yoga. Funny enough, that's what brought me into teaching yoga. It didn't do anything to my symptoms, but it gave me a second career. But because the symptoms can be like a chameleon, it's so hard to associate endometriosis with it. And back then, I saw probably 15, 20 doctors and did loads of tests, and none of them suspected endometriosis because I did not complain of period pain. And the bowel and the bladder symptoms only manifested afterwards. So even in Ireland, when they did 2 ultrasounds and an MRI that I paid privately for, and it took me 3 years on a referral to the gynecological services, and multiple emergency referrals of my GP to make them aware that I should be seen really soon because he cannot deal with my pain anymore. Because, like Daryl probably knows as well, Ponstan doesn't do anything, Buscopan doesn't do anything. You're eating Solpadeine, prescription Solpadeine, like Skittles, doesn't even scratch the edge of the pain. Going to A&E is useless because they just tell you to suck it up and there's nothing they can do. So you just don't go to A&E anymore because you'd rather be at home dealing with the pain.
They're just wasting hours. I did speak to somebody before who went to the emergency department because she was in so much pain and they just treated her like she was, you know, addicted to prescription medications and that she was just angling for that. That's what she was angling for because the pain was so immense. And Derval, that's where, you know, you founded the Frendo app, which is, well, perhaps you'll explain it, but I know that you have a symptom tracker in it and it's a way that people can kind of track these symptoms and I suppose arm themselves with information for when they approach a medical professional.
Yeah, I did. It was obviously out of my own frustrations and experience, I suppose. I was living in Australia and I was working with KPMG's startup division and it was after my third laparoscopy where I just decided, okay, I have to make some significant changes in my life. And one was kind of moving back home and then the other was, you know, I wanted to do something for endometriosis and with endometriosis. And at that time, you know, I was looking for a community and connection. And all I could find really on Facebook forums was quite negative, negative angles. And so I developed Frendo really initially as a social network and a community. And then we developed it further into an endometriosis tracker. So it is an app that's available on the app stores where those who either are diagnosed or who have suspected symptoms can track their symptoms, can screen for the disease and also plan for appointments with a doctor as well. You know, I used to always try to bring someone in with me because they can be quite invasive and they're quite emotional as well. So I always found myself forgetting things. So the app allows you to track all your symptoms. And what we're finding is both GPs and patients find it very, very valuable because, as I mentioned before, GPs are still learning about this. So, you know, this gives them a more accurate history of a patient and it empowers the patient to actually be able to articulate exactly what's been going on. And so they can either export that and send it to their GP or they can just show it to their GP. And I think, you know, what we find and what I hope is that it gives them a sense of validation as well. When you're sitting there with a doctor and he or she says, you know, this is just period pain. Well, actually, look, you know, I've missed 3 days of work. I've missed, you know, it's only this. These are the times around ovulation or period or 70% of the month. And it's really impacting my relationship, my career, my quality of life, my home work, housework, that kind of thing. So, yeah, so we've recently then launched Frendo at Work, which is a workplace program as well to support people in the workplace, again, to bring them back to work quicker and provide, like Johanna said, a multidisciplinary program. Because, you know, we've got to remember this is a chronic illness. So you can have a surgery, but you've still got to go back into the world. And there is a chronic systemic nature to this disease. So what we're trying to do is bring as many stakeholders into this as possible with employers, with clinicians, with government to really kind of take action. And the workplace program not puts the onus on the employer, but enables them to support people with this disease through awareness, communication and the tools around a multidisciplinary program as well.
Yeah, because the awareness piece is really important, isn't it? Because there are lots of people who might even say, oh, yeah, I've kind of heard of it. I don't really know what it is. And I think what's so difficult about endometriosis is it's a bit like IBS, which is not one thing. IBS is a collection of symptoms, as is endometriosis. So it's very sort of mercurial in that respect, I suppose. And even just letting employers know what it is and that it's not just period pain and you're not skiving off for a day, a month, that even on its own is quite important, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And if I look back at my own personal experience in the, you know, corporate world, let's say, my biggest challenge was finding out how to explain it, really, and, you know, what the disease was, but also how it was really impacting me. And so we provide that communication, that way to for them to be able to communicate with their managers. We recently had an event and with Salesforce, and afterwards, two of them, a manager and employee, came up afterwards, and she was discussing, you know, in a teary way, in a very emotional way, how this disease was really impacting her job and her life, and how she'd missed more work than she wanted to because of a recent surgery. And the manager steps in and she says, you know, despite that, or in spite of that, you're still my top performing team member. And really what was missing there, and I suppose what I'm excited about Frendo at Work, is they both, the manager really wanted to support the employee and her team member. She just didn't know how. And often the case is they're worried about what they'll say or if they'll say something wrong. So providing organisations with the, as you said, the correct information around the disease, but also some tools about how to support employees, is absolutely crucial.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And Johanna, I wanted to talk about the work that you do as well, because I have endometriosis as well, and I had a laparoscopy to diagnose it, and I still had pain afterwards, and I was feeling really very disheartened about it, even though I was, you know, diagnosed with stage one, which is the mildest form of it. I was really disappointed I was still having all this pain, and my gynecologist said, well, it's because pain is multifactorial, and you know, sent me to a pelvic floor physiotherapist, which I found great benefit from. Is that the line of work that you're in too?
So when you're talking about the staging, it's really important to know that the staging of endometriosis, which goes from 1 to 4, 1 being classified as not as widespread and 4 being classified as the most widespread, that has nothing to do about how debilitating the symptoms and the pain are. So you can have stage 1 and have severe symptoms. You can have stage 4 and have no symptoms and silent endometriosis. So the problem can also be that the majority of the gynecologists, not being trained enough and experienced enough, don't have the expertise to fully remove the endometriosis lesions from all organs. So there's a high chance then that they leave lesions behind. And that is, in the majority of the cases, the problem. And that's when way more symptoms are being left behind after surgery. So there's a difference between actual expert excision and a gynecologist with a special interest in endometriosis, because the outcomes are simply not as good. And either way, because excision is still not a cure, but it just really gives you the biggest chance of quality of life back, it's important to have a multidisciplinary team for pain management. And that is a pelvic health physio. So not just a normal musculoskeletal physio, but a physio who has specialized in pelvic health. There should also be a dietitian on the team, a counselor on the team, a specialist endometriosis nurse. And again, that is suggested by international standards and the NICE guidelines, but it is not the case in Ireland at the moment. So women have to seek all that support and pay for it themselves. And specifically pelvic health physio can make a huge impact, because they're trained to assess the pelvic floor from the inside. So it's a bit like a dentist who doesn't look into your mouth.
Yeah, that's a, it's a funny dentist, all right.
Exactly. So you kind of want someone who is trained to assess your pelvic floor internally, vaginally, to see how is the bladder, the bowel doing, how is your pelvic floor doing, is there any tension, any weakness, is there any leaking, is there any prolapse, because those symptoms can be helped with pelvic floor therapy. Dietitian-wise as well, there isn't one specific diet or one way of eating that would help everyone, but especially the Mediterranean diet and sticking to it generally can be more helpful for people with endometriosis. The most important thing to say is, though, that people have various symptom relief with those therapies. So they can modulate the symptoms. They can be so good in modulating and dialing down the symptoms that some people feel perfectly fine. For some people, they don't do much. And it's important to know that any of those treatments, whether it's pelvic health physio or using your diet or going to a massage therapist, to acupuncturist, taking any supplements whatsoever, none of those therapies treat the disease. They help modulate the symptoms. And it might be enough for someone to just treat the disease that way and not going down the route of surgery, but it's important to know that it's a progressive disease. And not surgically removing it has a high impact on the disease growing, progressing, and destroying your organs more, causing more pain, more organ dysfunction, and more infertility down the line. We still don't know who this will happen to and where it'll just like stay and where it'll just go better with time. But it's important to know that no matter when you opt for non-surgical treatment, the disease is still progressive, but you might be choosing to not go the route of surgical treatment if you feel you take the chance of it possibly progressing, but right now your symptoms are modulated enough that you have an okay quality of life.
Mm, yeah, and you have to weigh that up. And when you talk about a multidisciplinary team, why don't we have that in Ireland? I thought we had a brand new, you know, endometriosis centre opening in the Coombe Hospital in Dublin, and that this is where you would be able to go to get access to all that expertise.
So the National Endometriosis Framework that's been released, I think, from the Minister of Health last year is supposed to set up 3 dedicated endometriosis centres in Tala in Cume and 1 in CMH down in Cork. And in accordance to the national guidelines, who say you should have a specialist team with an endo nurse, with the physios, the dietitians, the pain management, and especially a gynecologist, a radiologist, an urologist, and colorectal surgeon, and possibly even general surgeon, thoracic surgeon, who all have experience and expertise in endometriosis in order to best serve the people. Those centers have received a lot of funding and they will be set up soon. The problem is that the people running those centers still don't have enough training and expertise to actually deal with moderate to severe cases.
And is that a cultural issue that we have, Johanna?
It's a global issue.
Yeah.
It's not just an Irish issue.
Why are some countries better than others? Like, why would you be able to get this expertise in Romania but not in Ireland?
Because simply there's a couple of surgeons, a couple of gynecologists who have realized that the old way of treating it with ablation, with hormonal contraception, with shutting down your ovaries, with really strong hormonal medication, that this is not a very efficient way of dealing with the disease. They have severe side effects. They might work in some people, but they don't work in a lot of people. So those gynecologists and surgeons have gone the route of only specializing in endometriosis. They're not dealing with any other gynae cases. They're not delivering babies. All they do is endometriosis. So they had enough time to specialize in the area to further their surgical skills, to further their training, their diagnostic and their treatment skills. So they are way more equipped to be able to deal with the disease and they have way better outcomes. And like in with the example of the Romanian center, this was one specific surgeon who just decided to really focus on endometriosis because the way he's been treating it, and quite a few surgeons are treating it, has way better outcomes. And because the outcome was so good, then suddenly loads of people from all over the world started referring to him, traveling to him. So now this center is receiving 95% of international clients. But we do need more surgeons like that who are able to really deal with the disease in all its facets. And Ireland is a very small country. with just around 5 million people population. So it will be really difficult to get enough surgeons to be trained enough, to be experienced enough to deal with all the endometriosis cases. But we still need to start training those people. And hopefully in 5, 10, 15 years, the surgeons we have at the moment will have enough experience and training. But the problem is also that the way the HSE is working is those surgeons are bound by their contract. They are still, even if they wanted to, they still can't focus solely on endometriosis patients. They still have to deliver babies, deal with other gynae clinics, and they don't get enough time in the theatre to actually develop the skills. So while those handful of surgeons might already be a little more skilled and a little bit more educated than the average gynecologist, it's still not enough for the majority of the cases who have more debilitating symptoms and who need just better skill in terms of treatment and diagnostic.
Dervil, it can be a long time before you get to the point of meeting a surgeon for endometriosis. So I suppose if people are listening, like, what kind of information do you need to arm yourself before you approach the first gatekeeper, which is the GP? I mean, I'm sort of not surprised there's so much misinformation about or lack of awareness about endometriosis, because I was actually on the WHO's website earlier today and I found a quote which basically said that, these adhesions outside the pelvic cavity are rare. It's not my understanding that these are rare at all. And so if you have somebody like the WHO with this on their website and a patient comes to them and says, no, they're wrong, you know, you're going to be at nothing, because the doctor's going to be like, well, I think the WHO should have the most up-to-date information and you might be just a crazy lady. And I know that that obviously has been your experience at times because you have been through 20 different doctors. So I'm wondering if somebody wants to approach a GP for the first time, what they need to do to advocate for themselves, you know, that they're not just sent away with a recommendation to go on the pill and, you know, come back to me when you're trying to get pregnant.
Yeah, I think certainly diarise, you know, really be very, very clear on your symptoms. And, you know, it's a sad state of affairs when we have to kind of be almost be studious around this, but we do, because I think we're almost teaching them as well. We're trying to get an accurate history across. But I think there's a real misinformation out there. And I think that's where kind of digital health technologies and these services do wonders. But I would absolutely empower yourself by going with as much information as possible. And that's really not just around kind of, you know, your period symptoms. That is really go into detail around, okay, this impacted my social life. This, you know, I cancelled this. I can't, to really show your quality of life is being severely interrupted or even interrupted at all. So painting the whole picture, I think, is crucial. And whether that's writing notes down, using Friendo, however way you want to, but going in prepared. I also think if I think back to kind of being a younger woman, and I felt, yeah, when I felt dismissed or I felt, you know, I hate the thought of younger women kind of sitting there and being told, no, this is done and dusted and off you go. What I would love for people to understand is to really just trust themselves and trust how they feel. And also then find, if your GP is not offering you that trust, find a nurse, find a therapist, find someone who you can trust. I think as well, I do think GPs are getting a lot better, and I think there's a huge primary care focus as opposed to surgeon. Because, you know, if we think of both of, you know, Johanna's and my situation, very long years of the growth of the disease. So realistically, by the time it gets to a surgeon, it's not like it's too late, but it has progressed. And you know, we look at Australia, they've opened 20 clinics within primary care, within GP clinics, where they are not just screening for the disease, but providing that multidisciplinary approach, starting pelvic health at a very early stage. And there are things that I believe Ireland could be doing, as well as the UK, you know, really investing in that earlier point of contact, that those first signs and symptoms of the disease, as opposed to us waiting for more surgeons to be trained, because that is, it's a challenge, and we can't just continue to put pressure on the system in that way. I feel like we have to support one another, and whether it's with digital health solutions, with GPs, it's about working together and getting this as early as possible.
And Johanna, I wanted to ask you as well about the yoga, because I feel that if somebody, like you said, that you would take Solpadeine-like Skittles and it doesn't even touch the sides of the pain, if I had gone to a doctor, and I can vouch for the fact that it is like unmedicated labour, because I have had unmedicated labour and endo, and I can say, yes, yes, they do match in terms of pain levels. If a doctor had said to me, have you tried yoga? I would have gotten up and slammed the door. So how does yoga help manage symptoms?
So you have to differentiate how strong the symptoms are, because patients are always being told, do some yoga, do some relaxation.
Always, yes.
Exercise is important for you. If you have very severe symptoms, that's just like a slap in the face. I know it myself. When I had very severe pain, there was no way of doing yoga. There wasn't even any way of focusing on anything on my body, or even not moving, but doing meditation, because just the simple act of focusing on my body was so debilitating, because there was so much pain at every moment. You just couldn't do that. But saying this, when there are times of where the phases are getting easier and the flares are easing, yoga, movement, physiotherapy, guided by someone who has more expertise and experience, can be quite helpful, because it can help you to recognize when there is tension, when something needs more relaxation. It can help recognize when somewhere is a weakness that needs a little bit more strength. It can help you rock with your breath, to help you relax a little bit more, and especially help you get through the very painful phases. So while there isn't really a training out there yet, I found myself using a lot of practices that I knew from labor prep, things physios learn to support women through labor and to prepare women for end-stage labor. And those relaxation movement techniques, those relaxation and pain management techniques, I found myself were some of the very few things that actually helped myself through the very strong debilitating pain episodes. So you can't just say do this and that, the way how it's often just being portrayed on social media. My three most favorite exercises, yoga, stretches, whatsoever for endometriosis, I think that is quite unfair. It needs to be tailored. You need to see what sort of pain is the patient experiencing, what do they have in sort of stress management and pain management skills, and what techniques might possibly help that person to deal with the pain a little bit better. Because being so long in pain and not being helped, and we know that the average time it takes to get a diagnosis is between 7 and 10 years. It's a little longer in Ireland. And on average, people see around 8 to 10 practitioners before they're actually being taken serious and getting a diagnosis as well. And that will add stress and anxiety, and that will make your pain more chronic the longer the pain goes on and the longer you feel you're not helped. So it's really unfair then to say to someone as well, you just need to reduce your stress levels and need to deal better with it, because the pain and not being believed for so long and not being treated for so long will raise your stress levels and your pain levels. So teaching people that it's not their fault, but there is a way how they can be helped to possibly manage and take the tip off the iceberg, off the edge of the pain, can be quite helpful. It won't make the lesions go away. It won't stop the progression of the disease, but even just to help them get through the pain episodes, help get through the worst until they can function a little bit more again. And that's quite important.
And maybe give you a feeling of caring about your body. I think, Dervil, you spoke about that before, because the thing is, when you have endometriosis, you're a bit sort of detached from your own self, because you're thinking, why is my body doing this to me? And so I suppose it can bring you back into that compassionate mode again.
Yeah. Because you feel like your body betrayed you. You're not safe in your body. And it can be quite tricky to work with that, to deal with that.
Dervil, there is a pattern, and we don't know what it's a correlation more than causation, that endometriosis can mean that you have problems getting pregnant. I hate using the word infertility. It kind of drives me mad. But I know that that was something that you struggled with and you got there in the end. Not everybody does, but please tell me about your very happy story.
Yeah, it's a very happy story. And I think, you know, it's always important to have happy stories in amongst these extremely challenging ones. And But I had been told for a large part of my life that I would not conceive naturally, and I hadn't. And but I was 39, and it was the start of the pandemic, and I, against all odds and great surprise, super happy surprise, became pregnant, and I have a wonderful, we have a wonderful 3-year-old daughter now. And, you know, I'd love to be able to say I know what the miracle was, or the, you know, that what happened, but I don't really. I do know that, you know, it kind of what Johanna was talking about there, because it was the start of the pandemic, I found myself in a more relaxed environment. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. I was trying to keep myself fit. When I had, you know, flare-ups, I was able to rest. But yeah, I mean, I don't like to be the one kind of saying, like, I had stage 4 endo and I was older, and so if it happens to me, it can happen to anyone, because I don't like to say that. But I do like to talk about it, because I think it is important, despite the fact that, you know, 50%, up to 50% of those with endo can suffer from fertility challenges. But yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned earlier, I don't know if I would have been able to have another baby before my hysterectomy, but it is an absolute miracle to have her. And I will say that it is a myth also that the disease gets better after you have a child. An absolute myth, because if anything, it got worse for me, you know, as mentioned in that comment. But yeah, I think we have to remember that there are positive little linings, you know. And it's strange. I have some funny emotions. You know, I think it was I had a good pregnancy, but I had a worrying pregnancy. And I think that's to do with health anxiety that many of us actually are affected by, because of dealing with a lot of this on our own for quite some time, and feeling the dismissal that we've felt and not knowing what's going on in our body. I think I took about 5 pregnancy tests when, you know, before the doctor, and then during the pregnancy, I was just really nervous. I kind of expected it to end, you know, I expected it to, for my body not to work, you know, because it really had never worked in, you know, inverted commas, but it did. And it was amazing, and still is. Yeah. Very, very lucky.
It's really important, Dorla, to highlight that, because so many people are afraid, or have endometriosis. This means I will never have a child. And while up to 50% of people with endo are having an issue with infertility, up to 70% still do conceive. So that's something important to remember. It's not a death sentence, and it's absolutely possible. It will depend on the case, obviously, as well.
I think that's a really happy note to end on. But before we go, I did say we would just discuss the cross-border directive. And Johanna, I'm just wondering, if somebody's listening and they're thinking, how do I get to the point where I can go for this gold standard surgery abroad? Can you briefly outline what are the steps? Who do you need to talk to? Who do we need to bang on the door to say, refer me to this person abroad, not anyone we have here in Ireland, please?
Yeah. So that was actually surprisingly simple enough. You will have to know about it yourself, because not a single doctor ever mentioned it to me here in Ireland. But if you are an EU citizen, you can access treatment abroad in any other EU country, and it will be reimbursed by the EU and the HSE. You can just go into the HSE website and look up the cross-border directive, the CBD. So it's a directive that allows you to get reimbursed for any diagnostic or treatment you have in another EU country. And you can even access it if you have private health insurance, but if you're being referred by a public consultant. So if you do not have private health insurance, then the way it usually is, you get either a GP referral or a consultant referral. And the HSE website lines it out really clearly what you need to do. And it's simple enough to get those things, referral letter and Then your surgeon abroad has to fill in a couple of things just to prove that you had the surgery, to prove that you paid for the surgery. And then you're just keeping all your papers together. And once you had your diagnostic or your treatment abroad, you're just sending it all into the HSE, and you will get your treatment costs or your diagnostic costs reimbursed. You won't get any flights and any accommodation reimbursed, but it makes a huge difference getting the cost of surgery and diagnostic reimbursed. And that I find, like, a lot of people do access the cross-border directive through the HSE. It's a very simple, straightforward procedure, which makes it possible for so many of us to travel abroad in order to get treatment.
Mm, I think it would be a lifeline for people suffering the most debilitating form of the condition. Johanna Huber and Dervil Ormond, thank you so much for joining us on the Women's Podcast today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.